I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome to Radio Times. Ned Blackhawk, reviewing the heartbeat of Wounded Knee in the New York Times, noted that in the past year, two Native American women were elected to Congress. Minnesota voters elected an Ojibwe woman lieutenant governor. Two Native American women won MacArthur Genius Awards. That's a partial list and the sign of rising power and prominence of American Indians. Our guest, David Troyer, is the author of that book, The Heartbeat of Wounded Knee. It's a corrective and counter-narrative to Dee Brown's 1970 best-selling book titled Bury My Heart at Wounded Knee. Brown wrote that the 1890 massacre of Lakota Sioux in South Dakota destroyed the culture and civilization of the American Indian. Troyer says he read that book in college and knew it was wrong because he wasn't destroyed, nor was his family, his tribe, or his reservation. He's Ojibwe, grew up on a reservation in Minnesota, has a PhD in anthropology, and is a writer. This is his seventh book. David Troyer joins us on Radio Times to talk about the resilience of Native Americans in the face of forced relocations, boarding schools, government betrayals, and more. David Troyer, it's a great pleasure. Nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
You know, I was saying to you before we went on the air, I remembered in 1970, I was one of those people that bought Bury My Heart at Wounded Knee, and I was so moved by the story. I was so sad, frankly, about reading that story and feeling this great loss, but also this kind of connection to a world that was not familiar to me. Help us understand your reading of it.
Yeah, well, my reading of Dee Brown's classic might be a little more complicated because on one hand, he devoted incredible energy and compassion and expertise to exploring Native American history. And for that, you know, I think we should remain grateful. But on the other hand, on the very first page, he announces the death of American Indian civilization and culture. And he says, you know, the massacre at Wounded Knee was the end of American Indian life.
Right.
And then on the very second page, he says, so if you happen to travel to a contemporary Indian reservation and see the poverty and the hopelessness and the squalor, these are his words, perhaps by reading my book, you will understand why. And so on one hand, of course, I felt lifted up. And with the other hand, I felt like he put us in our grave.
Well, in fact, you've been quoted as quoting Mark Twain, who said famously, you know, the reporting of my demise is a bit premature or whatever.
Right. Greatly exaggerated.
Greatly exaggerated. Yeah. I mean, this idea that somehow this is we're talking about the death of a Native culture that was obviously here before white folks got here.
Right. And not just a Native culture, but Native cultures, because there are over 500 American Indian tribes extant today, and there are over 320 federally recognized tribes and their languages and religions. And so it's Native American cultures. And yes, you know, we remain. And that's something that Dee Brown's book, and by extension, the popular imagination has a difficult time accepting.
Right. Well, I'm thinking that I don't know if it's still around, that picture of the Native American with a great tear in his eye.
Oh, that's a commercial from the 70s?
Yes. Right. Well, that's how old I am, but
that's an anti-littering commercial, right. And Don't Pollute.
Yes.
And the crying Indian, of course, the actor who played him, Iron Eyes Cody, was Italian. wasn't even Native. And so it's a big joke in Native communities.
I'd love to have you read from the very beginning of your book, because I think it kind of sets the stage for the book and for our conversation.
Sure. This is from, as you say, early on, page 11. This book is a counter-narrative to the history that has been told about us, but it is something more as well. It is an attempt to confront the ways we Indians ourselves understand our place in the world, our self-regard, the vision and versions we hold of who we are and what we mean matters greatly. We carry within us stories of our origins and ideas about our families, our clans, and our communities. Sadly, these narratives do not always or even mostly stand in opposition to the ways in which we are read by outsiders. We often, too often, agree with accounts of our own demise. For many years, too many years, I understood my reservation, Leech Lake Reservation in northern Minnesota, only as a place of abject suffering, a nowhere place where nothing happened and good ideas went to die. I saw it as in America, but not of America. I saw myself and my tribe as a ruined people whose greatness lay behind us.
Describe Leech Lake where you grew up. Well, as a kid, where you grew up.
Well, my understandings have evolved over time, and those understandings I just relayed in that passage were the ways in which I thought of that place as a kid. And as a kid,
because you believe that narrative as well?
Sure. I think I, and I can't speak for other Native people, but I think other Native people as well, have borrowed the same understanding that informs Dee Brown's book as our own understanding. It's, you know, we're as susceptible to the virus of influence as anyone else. And the fact is that the dominant narrative that is used to describe Indian lives is a tragic narrative. That's the only storytelling mode that is really used to think about Native folk. And that's the narrative I inherited, and that's the narrative I used, you know, to frame my understanding of the world. And it was only after I left Leech Lake and I came out to New Jersey for college, it was only when I was separated from home and my family and my tribe that I was finally able to see it as a place not just of suffering, to see my reservation not merely as a basin of pain, but as a place that was interesting and vibrant and complicated.
Well, you even write on the next page that even looking at your own family, and we should talk about your parents because that's an extraordinary story, but there was death and murder and, you know, things that are tragic no matter where you come from.
Right. And part of the problem was that, yes, there are difficult things with which Native people have to contend, as you mentioned, even in my own family. Mm-hmm. But that those aren't the only things. But those were the only things I could see for a while.
Right. Until you left.
I left. And also tried really hard to practice a different way of seeing. And maybe that comes from being a novelist. I don't know. But tragedy, the opposite of tragedy is not hope to me. The opposite of tragedy is complexity. Because tragedy turns us into statistics, Native people, turns us into statistics, and turns our lives into a condition. So to undo that, to do something different, to write a counter-narrative, not just a counter-history, I have to write a story of complexity and depth and layers and with texture, because that's really what it is to be human after all.
And I do want to get to that. Let me ask you a bit about your parents and your mom, Ojibwe. She's a lawyer. She went to nursing school. She went to law school and has worked as a judge as well. Help us understand your mom. Extraordinary woman, I should say.
She is an extraordinary woman. You know, I think I spent my life trying to understand my mother because, as James Baldwin says in his beautiful essay, Notes of a Native Son, where he's writing about his father. It's Ta-Nehisi Coates who writes in Between the World and Me. He said to his son, "You're not black in the way that I am, and I'm not black in the way my father was. And so in many ways, I can't understand him and I can't understand you. And I feel much the same. My mother is Native in a way and grew up in a way that I can't understand. So my mother is a tough nut. And she grew up in a kind of poverty that I can't fully appreciate and found a way to want something for herself in a time and place where Native people, particularly Native women, were not expected to want anything at all except the lives that the state had determined they should live.
Where did that come from for her?
I don't know. But her own father asked her what she was going to do when she was graduating from high school. And she said, "Well, I want to go to nursing school maybe." And he says, "Who do you think you are? You think you're better than me?"
Wow.
And she said, "Yeah, I do." And she went to nursing school. And then when she and my father got together, they ended up working on a program together for the reservation, a healthcare program. And they got married and had my brother and then they had me. And he asked her, he said, "If you could do anything, what would you do?" And she said, "It's stupid. I don't want to say." And he said, "Well, we're just talking. There's no harm in talking." And she said, "Well, we've been screwed over by the law for so long. And I don't know any Indian lawyers. I'd like to do that." And he said, "Well, let's try." She says, "It's stupid." He said, "Let's just try." And so she applied to law school without a college degree.
Yeah, pretty incredible.
And got in and then became the first American Indian woman judge in the country. I don't know where she got it, but she's pretty special.
Well, and your father, Jewish, survived the Holocaust, came to America when he was a young teenager, married your mom, obviously, and felt, as you write, more comfortable on the reservation than he did in other communities?
Yeah. As he explained it to me shortly before he passed away, he said, I wasn't wanted anywhere. I wasn't wanted by anyone. I wasn't wanted in Austria as a Jew. I wasn't wanted in America as a refugee. And he lived a long life before he ever came to Leech Lake. He had a first family and a first marriage, and they all moved to the reservation where he taught high school. And he said, when I got to Leech Lake, when I got to the reservation, I finally felt like I was in a place that I understood and that understood me, in a place where I could make a difference and where I was accepted. And I don't think he was wrong. It's not a fantasy. He had deep, deep connections to the community, and he devoted his life to working with and for Native people. And he was the least paternalistic paterfamilias I've ever known.
What do you mean by that?
He believed fundamentally in the intelligence and competence of Native people. He never felt like, I'm an outsider with all the knowledge who's going to come here and tell you how you should be and how you can fix your lives. He always approached Native people thinking, how can I help you do what you want? Mm-hmm. How can I help you achieve what you want to achieve? What do you want to achieve? What do you want to accomplish? And he was very unusual in that regard in the 50s and 60s and 70s to be like that.
So what was it like to have parents like that? I mean, not that you could run the alternative of not having parents like that.
I don't know. Of course, as a teenager, I didn't like it. I wanted a different family. I wanted a more normal.
Don't all teenagers?
Of course they do.
They want a different set of
I
parents.
I wanted what I thought it was parents. A normal family. And I forget which novelist said this, but the closer you look at a person, the stranger they become. And so I looked very closely at my family, and they all seemed very strange. And my friends' parents and families, they seemed very nice and normal. Of course, once I looked at them closely, I realized they were strange too. So what was it like? My parents were really clear. They said, you're going to do things. You're going to achieve something. You're going to work in some fashion. And we don't care what that is, as long as you're doing something to help other people. It was that simple for them. Mm-hmm. And they were fiercely invested in the idea that I'm on this earth to help other people.
Well, let's take a very short break and we'll get back to our conversation. That's David Troyer, our guest on Radio Times today. He's written a new book. It's called The Heartbeat at Wounded Knee, and it's in part, as he said, a kind of a corrective for Dee Brown's 1970 best-selling book, Bury My Heart at Wounded Knee. We're going to talk more about Native culture, about boarding schools, about Richard Nixon. There's much more that we're going to talk about, so hang around. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne talking with David Troyer. He's an Ojibwe from the Leech Lake Reservation in northern Minnesota, author of now 7 books. And we've been talking about his new one called The Heartbeat of Wounded Knee, Native America from 1890 to the present. As you said, once you left the reservation and kind of looking back on it, you saw it differently. And now you've got a couple of kids. And what is their relationship to the reservation? You live there part-time during the year.
Yeah, part-time during the year. My children are Ojibwe on my side and Seneca on their mom's side. And so they have 2 tribal communities to which they belong and 2 tribal communities in which they feel really, really comfortable. And for them, going back to Leech Lake feels like a homecoming.
Yeah,
That to them is home in a really fundamental way. And they seem very unconflicted about the kind of back and forth travel that really defines not just their lives, but the lives of a lot of Native people. But after I left, I was determined to return.
Mm-hmm.
And I went to grad school in Michigan and then dropped out and moved back to the reservation, lived there for a number of years, and then ever since then have been trying to find some way to balance my need to root myself there and a way to balance my need to flow out with the current around the country and to be in the mix.
Well, in fact, you talk about the sort of urbanized Indian, if I can – I'm not sure if that's the correct kind of language or not. But the fact that certainly after World War II, there was a lot of migration to cities and things, you know, people sort of creating their own communities within communities outside of the reservation.
Right. People are fond of noting that the majority of Native Americans live in cities now rather than on reservations. But that's not entirely true. The majority of Native people don't live on reservations, but most of us live in small urban areas, small towns and suburbs, as well as inner cities. But the majority of Indians live in towns like Harlem, Montana, and Bemidji, Minnesota, and Walker, Minnesota, places like that. And so there have been many diasporas. But that's one of the points of the book, is that you can't really understand American Indian history outside of American history. The migration of American Indian people from reservation communities to rural, suburban, and urban areas starting in the 40s and 50s can't be understood separate from the great migration of African Americans, for example, from the rural South to the urban North. It was part of a similar nationwide movement.
You write a lot about, and I was really very taken with the section about the Native American or the Indian boarding schools that were created. I guess the first one, maybe the most infamous one, I'm not sure, was in Carlisle, Pennsylvania. And I was wondering if you could read something that Richard Henry Pratt, I guess he was the founder of the school, what he wrote about the students that he thought he would be educating there.
Sure. It's difficult a little emotionally to read Pratt's words, but they're worth remembering. Just to remember what we've had to fight against. He writes, "A great general has said that the only good Indian is a dead one, and that high sanction of his destruction has been an enormous factor in promoting Indian massacres. In a sense, I agree with the sentiment, but only in this, that all the Indian there is in the race should be dead, kill the Indian in him, and save the man. Theorizing citizenship into people is a slow operation. What a farce it would be to attempt teaching American citizenship to the Negroes of Africa. They could not understand it, and if they did, in the midst of such contrary influences, they could never use it. Neither can the Indians understand or use American citizenship theoretically taught to them on Indian reservations. They must get into the swim of American citizenship. They must feel the touch of it day after day until they become saturated with the spirit of it and thus become equal to it."
It's horrifying language.
It is.
It's horrifying.
It is.
But that was the dominant perception and I guess policy at that time, which is to get the children away from their parents and Americanize them.
Right. The federal government wanted to get out of the Indian business. It wanted to be rid of what it considered the, quote, Indian problem, end quote. The best way to destroy tribes was to destroy Native families. And the best way to destroy them was to break the intergenerational transfer of knowledge and understanding and connection. And so it was, in fact, federal policy to remove Indian children from their homes.
Forcibly.
Forcibly in many instances, coercively in most instances. And in some few instances, Native people had no better options and willingly and gladly saw learning English and trades and things like that, that were these things that were studied in these schools as a viable future. Mm-hmm. So that shouldn't be forgotten either. Some Native people were all for it. Not many, but some. Right. And so many generations, I mean, these schools lasted from the late 1880s up through the 1930s and a few into the 1940s.
Wow.
And a couple generations of Native children were sent to these schools. But this is the thing that I think is so fascinating, that it would be easy, going back to this idea of tragedy versus complexity, it would be easy to only understand the history of residential boarding schools as an unmitigated tragedy. And certainly it was traumatic.
Because they couldn't speak their native language. They had to wear uniforms. I mean, all the attempts to erase that their
they culture and identity. They were forcibly converted to Christianity, forced to speak English, forbidden from speaking their native languages, couldn't practice their native religions. All those things were true and traumatic for native kids at these schools. On the other hand, you took all these native kids from all these tribes scattered across the country, tribes that were unknown to one another, tribes that perhaps had been traditional enemies of one another, and you put them in these schools, and these kids had to rely on one another. And they suffered the same injustices. They had the same experiences, and they built networks. They had friendships. They had romantic relationships. They got to know one another and learn from one another so that when they left those schools and they went back to their tribes – and they started working in tribal government or maybe for the federal government or maybe joined the army, maybe learned a trade and was a heavy equipment operator, whatever it might have been, they had a network of other native people on whom they could rely. So on one hand, these schools were designed to destroy tribes. On the other, in many ways, they helped Indians advance into the middle part of the 20th century by creating networks of support.
That's such a fascinating but important thing to understand about the sort of resilience in the face of attempts to essentially take away your identity, take away your culture, that you know people are, as you say, complicated. Your maternal grandmother went to a boarding school?
She did. My grandmother was my mom's mom, my grandma. She's still alive.
How old?
She just had her birthday. I want to say 96, 97.
Wow.
She was sent to Tomah Indian Boarding School in Wisconsin first, and then she went to Flandreau Indian School later for middle school and high school in Flandreau, South Dakota.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, in her mind, the way she describes it, she said it was fine. Do I think she's being truthful with herself? Not entirely. I think it was hard for her.
Right.
It complicated her relationship with her mother greatly.
And some of these children were so young. I mean, 4, 5, 6, 7
My grandmother was 6.
She was 6 years old. So to be taken from your family at that age.
She didn't return home for 4 years.
Wow, until she was 10 years old.
10 years old.
Yeah, those are such formative years, obviously. Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's David Troyer. He's Ojibwe from the Leech Lake Reservation. That's in northern Minnesota. He teaches literature and creative writing at the University of Southern California, went to Princeton University in our listening area. And we are talking about his new book. It's called The Heartbeat of Wounded Knee Native America from 1890 to the Present. 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. You also write, David, that a third of Native adult males served and fought in World War II. Now, I think we know about, you know, the code breakers and
code talkers.
But a third of it, I mean, I just think this is a piece of history we need to understand better.
Right. People always ask, why did Native people volunteer to serve at such a rate? And there's no one answer. There are many answers which overlap. For a lot of Native men, it was the best job you could get, that because the only other jobs open to you were seasonal or manual labor, day labor. So economics were a big motivator. There are cultural reasons why joining the armed forces were really important. There were certain ceremonial positions in different Native societies that you couldn't hold unless you were a combat veteran. So that's another reason for some people. And another reason which people have a hard time understanding was that they saw themselves as Native and they saw themselves as American, and they were and are deeply patriotic. And that's probably more like my grandfather, who served in the 2nd Infantry Division and served at Normandy and was wounded in the Battle of the Bulge. And he was very proud to have served America as well as represented our tribe.
You describe, because you came back, I think it was a book tour or something, took you to France, and you came back and you were talking to your grandfather.
Yeah.
And it seemed like that opened up a conversation that maybe he hadn't had before about serving during World War II.
He was a hard man to know and a hard man to like for me. We were not close when I was a little kid. He scared me. He was very frightening, sarcastic, bitter, at least to me, other people have entirely different reactions to him. Which is one of these things about people.
Yes,
you think
exactly.
You know them and you think you've got it. And then all of a sudden, even after their death, you'll turn a corner and then realize they were a completely different person. They existed in ways you couldn't possibly know. So he and I were never close when I was growing up. But when I'd gone to France, I came back and ran into him in the grocery store the day I got back from my very first time overseas. And he asked where I'd been. I said I'd been in France. And I think just because I'd been where he'd suffered so much, I was the only one in the family who had stepped on the land that had accepted his blood, quite literally.
Yeah.
That for whatever reason in his mind, and I don't pretend to know his mind, that connected us. And then in the last 10 years of his life, he really opened up to me and we talked a lot about the war and we became really close.
Oh,
and I grew to love
so nice.
Him very much before he passed away.
I mean, that's so poignant,
yeah.
So moving. As I said, this book covers a lot of history and a lot of that history includes pogroms and relocations and, as we mentioned, the boarding schools, the Trail of Tears and disenfranchisement that goes on and on and on. There's also something called the Dawes Act. And this is, if you can just help us understand what that meant for Native people.
Right. I should also step out and address a possible concern that listeners might have, which is that I wasn't really interested in writing a laundry list of abuse.
No, I get it.
Yeah.
Yes. And I apologize if it sounds
right.
That way. Yes.
And I was trying to show the complex nature of contemporary Native life. And part of that is hardship, but part of that is the creativity that we've applied to our own lives, right?
Sure.
And the Dawes Act is no exception. The United States government has tried again and again and again to do us in, either outright or through policy. And again and again and again, we've resisted and we've succeeded in not just surviving, but in thriving. So the Dawes Act was to sort of our relationship with the land that boarding schools were to ourselves. So the government wanted to get out of the Indian business. It wanted to be done with us. And so it thought we should break up reservations, which are holding us back from joining the mainstream. And so the Dawes Act basically broke up tribal community property and allotted small parcels to Native individuals as a means to encourage private ownership, which was the most American thing of all.
Of course.
And it succeeded in radically reducing our land base. It succeeded in fracturing us in many ways. But in many ways, we learned to adapt. You know, there was a diaspora at that time that, you know, if this is what's going to happen here, I'm just going to homestead like an American. And my land can't be taken from me. And so people made that work for them, homesteading, out in Kansas and Nebraska and things like that. So
you're still here.
Still here, right.
In spite of everything.
In spite of everything.
Let me quote something Richard Nixon said, and this was in 1970, and I'll just quote. He says, "The story of the Indian in America is something more than the record of the white man's frequent aggression, broken agreements, intermittent remorse, and prolonged failure. It is a record of endurance, of survival, of adaptation and creativity in the face of overwhelming obstacles. It's a record of enormous contributions to this country, its art, its culture," and he goes on from there. And I think people would be surprised to know that Richard Nixon talked that way.
I think they would
be. Or felt that way.
And maybe Nixon, just like Native people, you know, shouldn't necessarily be completely understood in relation to the darkest parts of his legacy. Because the fact is, he was arguably the best president for Native people in the last 50 years.
So interesting.
And he believed and he ushered in a new era of federal Indian policy, which has really been the policy ever since his term and a half, whatever, which was the era of tribal self-determination. Not unlike my father, Nixon believed that Native people and Native tribes were gifted, intelligent people who understood what was best for them, and that the government should honor its obligations, but it should quit with its paternalistic attitude and listen to Native people as they told the government what would work best for them. And so for that, I mean, Nixon deserves a lot of praise.
Yeah.
He really does.
Yeah. And he had a coach who I think was Native American.
He did. His football coach was, and I can't remember his name off the top of my head, was a Native American guy. And he said he learned more from him than from any other man in his life. And more from him, not just about football, but about what it meant to be a man. And perhaps, of course, maybe all those lessons didn't stick.
Maybe not.
Maybe not.
I'm curious about the reaction to your book.
So am I. I don't know.
Can you tell?
I can't tell. I really do believe, and this is something that drives my mom crazy, that I'm something of a contrarian, and I like to mix it up, and I like to get in trouble. I like to have arguments. And she said, why can't you just not do that? I said, Mom, I'm stuck being who I am. I'm 48. I don't think I'm going to change. She goes, I just worry about you. You make so many people mad. I said, well, if I was making everyone happy, I think I'd be doing something wrong. And I do believe that if you're going to do something, if it's something worth doing, it's not going to please everyone. So I am sure there are people who aren't into it. I'm sure there are people who disagree with my reading of, say, the Standing Rock protest.
Which I do want to talk about.
Who don't agree with the way I frame the excesses of the American Indian movement, who don't agree with lots of things. I haven't heard from many of them yet. I'm sure I will. Mm-hmm. But so far, I've heard mostly pretty great things.
Well, let's take another short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. That's David Troyer, our guest on Radio Times today. He's got a new book. It's called The Heartbeat of Wounded Knee, Native America from 1890 to the Present. We've got some folks that want to join our conversation. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And do stay with us. Much more to talk about after this very short break. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Artie Moscow, and again, talking with David Troyer about his new book, The Heartbeat of Wounded Knee, Native America from 1890 to the Present. Let me read a couple of emails. One from Shelley. I hear Pratt's words. That was the reading you did about the boarding school in Carlisle, Pennsylvania. I think remnants of that ideology still exist today. Some still find diversity, people being themselves, threatening. I think some people still feel that equal citizenship should only come after assimilation. Interesting. What are your thoughts on that?
I think she's right. But I also think that the American Indian context is different. We've never wanted equal rights exactly. We have wanted equal rights as Americans, but we also wanted a recognition of our unique legal status as members of sovereign Indian nations, which makes our situation very different than other ethnic minorities in the country. We don't simply want equal rights. We also want the government to remember and to honor our tribal rights, which have been our rights long before there was an America, to reduce them.
In fact, I read somewhere that you said, I'm Ojibwe, I'm Indian, and I'm American.
Yeah.
I mean, the sort of and.
Right. That's a great way to
Well, that I'm quoting you.
Well, that is a great way to put it.
So what is the American Indian dream? I mean, we talk about the American dream. What is the American Indian dream?
I don't know. I mean, the American dream is to sort of work hard and get ahead and do better than your parents. And of course, that dream has troubled our sleep for a long time.
Right.
You know, people like Fitzgerald point that out to us, that we've had troubled sleep for some while. The American Indian dream, I riff on this in the book a little bit, but I think it's different. It's that, too. We want to succeed. We want to move ahead. We're an ancient and modern people. That's important to remember. But I think also the American Indian dream is not just a reaching ahead, but it's also a reaching back. And we understand ourselves to be members of ancient cultures, and that is an understanding that informs how we view ourselves as individuals, how we view ourselves as members of tribes, families, clans, and how we view ourselves as Americans. our relationship to history is different, not just because our history is troubled, but because I think of our unique understandings. Of course, this is different from tribe to tribe. Sure. Every tribe is different. But I do think it's something one can say about Native people generally, that we dream a slightly different dream. And that works for us.
Yeah, yeah. What you said just remind me of when you described going, you know, back to the reservation and your mother there and all these sort of food traditions that are part of what you grew up with and the things that you like to do, the things that you don't like to do. I mean, of course, that's tradition for you, right?
Right. Yeah. What you're referring to is the fact that all through my youth, as my parents kept pounding the idea of education into me, I always had to do chores, regular American chores, but I also had to do other Ojibwe chores. I had to harvest wild rice in the fall, and I had to make maple sugar in the spring, and I had to pick berries in the summer, and I hated ricing, and sugaring gave me migraines, and my parents just thought I was being lazy. And then later in life, I asked my mom, I said, why did you make us go ricing, for instance? You hate ricing. You had to do it as a kid, and it was awful, and you thought it was demeaning, and you had to sell your rice just for school clothes. And she said, yeah, I hated it, and I prefer to buy my rice because I can afford to. She said, but I was going to make sure that you were going to succeed in America, but I was also going to make sure you succeeded as an Ojibwe person, and that if America didn't work for you, you could always come home, and you could feed yourself and take care of yourself, doing the things our people have done since time immemorial, that you were going to be good at that. And then as a grown-up, I now love those things.
Are you good at them now?
I'm okay. I can support myself. I can live off the land if I had to. And I miss doing those things. It is a good feeling. I miss doing those things so much now. And it pains me to be away during ricing season. It pains me to be away when we sugar down. I don't miss picking berries. That was never my thing. My brother was good at that. That was something that drove me nuts.
We have a tweet from Laurie. She says, I believe United States citizens should pay reparations to Native American Indians. How can we do that? And interestingly, Senator Elizabeth Warren has at least raised that idea or question or policy. What do you think about that?
I'm not sure exactly what I think about reparations in any kind of practical sense. I think a really good place to start, though, would be to honor the existing treaties on the books. That would be a good place to start. Let's see how far that takes us, because the government still isn't doing that much. And let's not forget that, you know, in our Constitution, it says that treaties are the supreme law of the land. So, America, why don't you live up to your founding documents and honor treaties? And then, you know, then we can, once we do that, let's discuss reparations. I don't know what reparations would look like. It's going to be different, right?
I guess it's money.
Well, I mean, we could use money, but I think more importantly, you know, our relationship to our homelands, our the need for the government to honor its promises, existing promises, would put Native people in a very different place than we are now, because we have, since the beginning, had to fight to keep that in America's view. And to keep, you know, we've had to fight for centuries, not just for our own rights. We've had to fight to make sure that America remembers herself and her founding documents, her obligations, her promises. So we're fighting for ourselves, and we're fighting for the angels of America's better nature too. I think it'd be nice to stop having to do that so much.
Asking America to live up to
its
her ideals and promises.
Right.
Here's an email from Mary. Can you guess expand on his thoughts on Standing Rock? You mentioned that earlier. What are your thoughts?
Right. Standing Rock was an interesting moment. And people have asked me, the protest failed. And how do you feel about that? And I said, I'm not so sure that it did the way I see it. Yes, that particular pipeline did get constructed in that particular place. And so on a very local level, the protest failed. Perhaps. But in a more expansive sense, I think it's been a success. For instance, our tribal council on my reservation approved a number of pipelines to pass through our reservation before Standing Rock. After that protest, our leaders know there is no way they can remain in office if they allow those pipelines to go through. It has changed the nature of tribal business and local business and regional business across the country. People know now they can't enter into the same agreements they might have before and for the same reasons.
Oh,
so it has changed things in fundamental ways. Those struggles go on in different places. But another thing, I was a little dismayed that the standoff at Standing Rock was framed by Standing Rock's tribal chairman, David Archambault III, who is a leader I respect immensely. But I didn't agree with the way he framed the conflict as yet another instance of cowboys versus Indians. This is something he said in a New York Times op-ed that he wrote. I said, that's not the story. The story isn't white versus native. And to tell that story is to miss the bigger, more fundamental story. This is a story of private interests versus the common good. Hmm. That's the story of Standing Rock. And Native people have been putting ourselves on the line for centuries to remind all of us that about the need to think communally, the need to think about the common good, the need to perhaps balance the role of the individual in American society versus the function of the collective. That's the real conflict at Standing Rock. And I think it's obscured when we take yet again, the white man's keeping us down. I'm like, well, not exactly.
Oh, so interesting.
Corporations are keeping us down.
Right. And the us is
all of us.
Is larger than just
all of
peoples.
Us. Right. Who need clean water, who need the needs of our communities to be respected over the needs for profit. Absolutely.
You also have some interesting, both critiques, but also commentary about the American Indian Movement, AIM. This was a movement from the 60s and 70s, in certain ways borrowing from the Black Panthers, and there were occupying Alcatraz, the Bureau of Indian Affairs. I mean, there was a lot of protest and activism. You also say that for some Indians, American Indians, AIM stood for asses in moccasins. What was the tension, I guess, between maybe the leadership and others?
Right. So the American Indian Movement, known as AIM, for shorthand, was any Native movement, like any Native thing that I cover in this book, a complicated thing. There were some leaders of the movement who were excessively violent, perhaps radically unethical, and in some ways personally destructive on one hand. On the other hand, they engaged in some really effective street theater that brought the simple fact that we remain, and we not only remain, but we remain engaged with the broader government, and we want that government to honor its treaties and obligations to us. And so it was very effective in some ways. And what's kind of lost when we think about some of the leadership are the ways in which the rank and file of the American Indian Movement, many thousands of Native people, did things and improved the lives of Native people all over the country by starting schools and health clinics and jobs training programs and things like that. These programs that still remain, schools that still remain, clinics that still remain.
Right.
And so that's often elided when we think about Russell Means or Dennis Banks and people like that. And so AIM was complicated, but it did a lot of good things too.
Yeah, I hear you. I wanted to wait to the end of the show to raise the question about Pocahontas, something our president has called in order to demean Senator Elizabeth Warren. What do you make, first of all, of her? And when she did apply, she did claim some Native American heritage, had this DNA test, and now she's basically apologized for claiming this identity for herself. What do you make of all of that?
Well, let's parse it a little bit.
Sure. I mean, that was pretty...
Right. She didn't claim a Native identity. She claimed a Native heritage.
Yes, correct.
She didn't claim a tribal affiliation, which is a legal designation. To be a member, an enrolled member of a federally recognized tribe is a legal designation that gives you access to many things, depending on what tribe you belong to.
Sure.
She didn't claim that either. All she said was that she grew up hearing stories that she was Native, and that makes her Oklahoman.
Because of all the sort of mixing and
Oklahoma
history.
Was Indian territory. There are, I mean, you can't spit in a room in Oklahoma and not hit somebody with some story about a Native background because of the nature of that place. And Oklahoma is, I was just there, is a unique, unique place in the country. There are Native people of all hues and dispositions and relationships to tribe. That just makes her Oklahoman. And she heard this growing up, so she put it on some documents.
Mm-hmm.
She was challenged. And let's face it, Elizabeth Warren's relationship to her Native heritage is the least interesting thing about her. What's interesting about Warren are her economic policies, which
have been consistent
over
decades.
Decades, and which are incredibly threatening to the status quo. So, of course, Trump, being the effective bully he is successfully stringing her up on the hook of identity politics and ridiculing her. And we're falling for the bait because here we are talking about it.
Right.
So her identity is uninteresting. Her heritage, I'm not particularly interested in it. I'm interested in her economic policies. Last time I checked, not only Native people, but a majority of Americans are not doing so well economically. That's what's important to us.
And that also goes – I did a little research just in preparation for the show about the poverty rate on a number of reservations. I think something like 39% average, and all the things that come with poverty as we know. So one can look at those numbers and look at the outside and say, oh, my, you know, this is a tragedy. You're obviously telling us that within those numbers and among those people, there is something that perhaps we don't see as outsiders.
Right. So, like I said, like we talked about in the beginning of the show, you know, for a long time, I just thought of my reservation as a place of where there's less of everything, less hope and less peace and less opportunity and less money, less. But over time, I've come to see my reservation and by extension, Indian communities across the country as perhaps the opposite, as places where there's more of everything. And that's how I kind of flipped the script for myself from tragedy to complexity. So if we think of reservations as places of surplus rather than deficit, then we can see something different. We have a surplus of poverty. There's no doubt about that. We have a surplus of crime, but also a surplus of laws. We have a surplus of poverty, but a surplus of hustle. We have a surplus of pain, but a surplus of creativity and humor. So if you can see them as more of everything, you begin to see the place differently. And if we can see our places differently, we can see the future differently.
Yeah.
So to say that I don't think the tragic narrative is doing us any good is not to say that there aren't real difficult things with which we have to contend. It's to say if you only focus on those things to the exclusion of other things, you miss the bigger picture. And by missing the bigger picture, you miss the opportunity to change life.
David Troy, it's been such a pleasure. Thank you so much. Thanks for coming in and joining us on Radio Times.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate being here.
I appreciate having you as well. And again, the book is called The Heartbeat of Wounded Knee, Native America from 1890 to the Present. And he, grew up on the Leech Lake Reservation in northern Minnesota. He's Ojibwe, and he's also a teaches literature and creative writing at the University of Southern California. Go to WHYY.org/Radio Times. And you can find out more about the program. You can download a podcast of the show. Find us on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Alex Hansen. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thanks for joining us.